When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This podcast is sponsored by Hollywood Casino in Charlestown, West Virginia. April's featured entertainment includes Los Lobos on the 12th, Josh Turner on the 13th, and The Steel Woods on the 26th. Details and tickets at HollywoodCasinoCharlestown.com. Must be 21 to enter the casino floor and attend a show. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Welcome to the newest episode of Beyond the Fame with Jason Fraley. I'm your host, Jason Fraley, picking the brains of the top filmmakers, musicians, and artists of our time. Actor Alan Ruck hosts a special screening of Ferris Bueller's Day Off this Thursday night at the Warner Theater in Washington, D.C. He joined me to discuss the legacy of John Hughes' 1986 coming-of-age classic, as well as his Emmy-nominated role as Connor Roy in HBO's Succession. Hey, Alan Ruck. Hey, thanks so much for joining us on WTOP in Washington, D.C.
It's my pleasure. How are you?
We're doing all right. We're talking because you're coming to DC's Warner Theater historic spot on Thursday, April 4th for a special screening of Ferris Bueller's Day Off, the 1986 classic. It's going to be showing. So how's it going to work? Is it going to be showing on the big screen and you do like a Q&A after, or how does it work?
I believe that's the idea. Yes, sir. It's just a screening of the movie, and then there may be a moderator. There may be somebody asking me questions, and I think there will be questions taken from the audience if anybody wants to talk about anything, and that's what we're going to do.
I love it. And actually, it's funny. Like a week or so ago, we just interviewed William H. Macy, who just did a similar thing. He brought Fargo to this same theater and screened it. So there might be some residue of the DLR plates, or what is it, Tan Sierra, of him fudging the used car numbers. I'm trying to tie it into your reversing the miles on the car, but I don't know what the analogy is.
Well, you're doing better than I could. So anyway,
you'll reverse the car into the wood chipper. There's some analogy there.
But
let's go into why it's Ferris Bueller. It's such an a beloved movie. I mean, it's lasted all this time, and new generations keep discovering it. But talk about, you know, why do you think that is? Is it just sort of like the road trip idea, sort of the idea that everyone, the ultimate dream of everyone, wanted to play hooky, but you guys did basically the coolest version of it ever?
I think that all plays into it. Good old Ben Stein, you know, who played the history teacher at the beginning of the picture. He said, "There's not a mean bone in the movie's body," and I think he hit the nail on the head. It's a movie about friendship. There's this guy who's leading his best life, and he's got the school wired, and he's 17 or 18 years old, and he's living large, and he could do anything with his day off, but what he decides to do is to try to cheer up his mopey friend. He's got this beautiful girlfriend that he could spend the whole day with, but he decides to pull his friend out of the doldrums and try to show him a good time. And I think there's something to that as well, that it's about friendship. There's no big message other than that.
Well, although it is deceptively profound in terms of like life moves pretty fast. If you don't slow down, you might miss it. Like, so there are some messages in it, but I think you're right. It is also mostly just that playing hooky kind of, it's just fun.
Yeah. There's that, absolutely. Life moves pretty fast. If you don't slow down, you could miss it, but there's no big political agenda. There's teen angst, certainly, with Cameron and his relationship with his father, but it's not adults aren't specifically targeted for retribution.
Right.
You know, there's no great revolution planned other than just having a good time and seizing the day.
Yeah, and having a good time, singing, you know, lip singing, twist and shout at the parade, and what was the yellow song, the oh yeah, chica chica. I mean, it's just fun. It's fun.
Yeah.
Tell me about sort of you know, you were gosh, I mean, you're a very iconic actor, and we can go into Succession later in the interview if you want. But I mean, at the time, you're such a young cast. You and I mean, it's like introducing us all to you and Matthew Broderick and Mia Sara and Jennifer Grey. This was before she did Dirty Dancing. Even a young Charlie Sheen shows up. So, like, yeah, just talk about sort of the you all being, you know, young and just starting in the industry together. I mean, was it kind of like a cool bonding thing that you guys would all skyrocket after that, but you all kind of started in this nucleus of this movie?
Well, Jennifer, I did my first professional play ever with Jennifer Grey. It was in Chicago. It was a play called Album. And she had been an understudy in the New York production. And then she was cast in the Chicago show. So she was kind of a lucky charm for me. Mm-hmm. And then Matthew and I, right before this movie, had been on Broadway together in Biloxi Blues. Mm-hmm. So I was already pals with both of those people. I didn't really have any scenes with Jennifer in the movie, but I was already friends with both of them. It was very comfortable, a lot of trust, you know, and that's key in any sort of cinematic endeavor. Trust is key. It's like I believe you're going to show up and do your job, and I'm going to do mine. And so it was a happy reunion with Jennifer, and kind of an extension of a new friendship with Broderick. Mia, of course, we all met on that movie. And it was kind of a little bit of a homecoming for me, because I had gone to the University of Illinois in downstate Illinois, in Champaign-Urbana. And then after school, I went right up to Chicago, and that's where I got started. And I was doing plays in Chicago and little pieces in movies. And then I got the Broadway show with Matthew. And then I came back home to film Ferris Bueller. So it was the whole thing was a gift. And it just I felt kind of like a big shot, you know, like I was coming home, like I'd gone home and I'd won a giant prize, and I'd come home and I was showing everybody how well things were going. So it was a very happy time in my life.
I love it. Absolutely. I'm sure it brings back just tons of fun memories when you watch it at these shows like Warner Theater. And of course we have to talk, I want to talk about John Hughes, because I mean, rest in peace, but, you think of all those great direct to camera address and, you know, all that stuff. So that's John Hughes written all over it. But I want to remind folks really fast, like just this guy's run. Not only he wrote and directed 16 Candles, Breakfast Club, Weird Science, Ferris Bueller, Planes, Trains, Automobiles, Uncle Buck, like that would be enough for most people. But then, oh yeah, he also wrote for other directors, Pretty in Pink, Vacation, Christmas Vacation, Home Alone. Like, I mean, it's unbelievable the guys run. But memories of working with him, you know, either as a man, you know, when the cameras weren't rolling, or when they were rolling, like, you know, just memories of John Hughes. What made him so special? And, you know, it's a loss losing him.
Well, he once said, you know how we all read Thoreau in high school, and we all had to keep a journal for as long as we were reading on, you know, on Walden Pond. He said, I never stopped doing that. Mm. And he would get this little moleskin, tiny little moleskin notebooks, and he would write very small, and he was constantly writing all day, every day. So it was just a natural extension of who he was. He started journaling as a kid, and then that led him to into advertising. And then from advertising, it led him into screenwriting. And so the very first play I did, I told you, with Jennifer Grey, was called Album. And we asked the playwright, whose name was David Rimmer, he's also gone now, like, which one of these characters became the writer? And he said, well, it was Jennifer's character, because she was the one that was constantly journaling.
Right.
Writers write. That's the way they process the world. And so John, he had that hat. It was habitual. He just wrote. Hmm. And he was very curious about the world. And he was very curious about kids. And I remember when we, in pre-production in Chicago, before we started work, I went with him to a record shop, and of course everybody knew who he was. And he was so up to date. I mean, he was probably 35, 36 years old at the time, but he was so up to date on what was happening, you know, cutting edge in the world of music. He was all over it. He was intensely curious. So I think that, I mean, I think that just makes for a happy life. Yeah. If you remain curious about the world and other people, and it sure paid off for him. I had met him in Chicago probably about 1982 or 83. He was going to do the Breakfast Club as sort of a little Chicago indie, because, like, as you said, he'd been writing the vacation movies for National Lampoon. And so he'd written this thing, and we were having auditions in Chicago, and I met him. And then during that process, he met Molly Ringwald and was instantly smitten with her. And the legend is that he wrote 16 Candles over a weekend for her. And actually, he wrote Bueller in 7 days. Wow. So he was prolific. He was fast. Mm-hmm. And that was another reason that the movie studios loved him, because it was just like, John, we're looking for something like this. Bam, a week later, he'd deliver it.
Cranking him out.
Yeah, he was really good. He was really talented.
All these crazy alien stories can't be true, can they? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
I'm Bradley Trainer,
and I'm Don McClain. We have a podcast called Blinded by the Item.
A blind item is gossip about a celebrity with their name left out. It's a guessing game, and you can play along. The item might be like, this A-list star carries a Birkin bag worth more than the average person's house to the gym to work out.
Pretty sure that's J-Lo.
And P.S., the person behind all of this is Kris Jenner,
LLC. We drop a new episode every weekday, so the fun never ends.
Blinded by the Item. Listen wherever you get podcasts, and watch us on the Blinded by the Item YouTube channel.
And so then when Bueller came along, I was working in New York on stage with Matthew, and in Biloxi Blues, Matthew spoke directly to the audience, as he had done in the previous Neil Simon play, Brighton Beach Memoirs. And so John was smart to hire Matthew, because he was so good at that. I mean, now that we're, you know, old men, maybe people forget, Matthew had such magic at that time. He was instantly likable. I mean, he looked great on camera, but he was just instantly likable, instantly relatable. And so that breaking the fourth wall thing, that hadn't been done in the movies since Alfie with Michael Caine.
Right.
In about 1966, it just hadn't been done. And so Hughes was really wise to pick Matthew.
Well, we had heard that they did it in Annie Hall a little, right? And some movies like that, I think, or maybe Blazing Saddles. There's a couple probably if we really think. But yeah, you're right. This was like the first big example that I can think of.
Yeah, I can't really remember. Maybe the Annie Hall thing. You're probably right. I don't know.
Yeah.
So we had heard that some years later, actually, that Hughes had written Bueller for Anthony Michael Hall, and had written Cameron for Emilio Estevez. And both those guys had worked with John, and I know that they enjoyed it, but they were moving on to other things. I can't remember what Anthony Michael Hall was doing at the time, but Emilio was making Repo Man, which was a very different kind of movie.
yeah.
So they turned it down, and then he was looking for a Ferris, and he was lucky to find Matthew. So, I mean, it was the best part in a movie I've had to date, truly. So I'll be forever grateful to John Hughes for putting me in that movie. And I had no idea. I don't think any of us did, that it would become this sort of cultural phenomenon. It was just, at the time, it was just a really good job.
Absolutely. Well, I wanted to spend most of this interview talking about Ferris Bueller because that's the event that you're coming. But I do want to remind everybody, you know, Matthew goes on and does Glory and shows his range. You do, you know, Speed, Twister with Jan DeBont, like some of the big action cool movies of the 90s, not to mention Spin City, where Cameron gets a team with Marty McFly in a sitcom. That's cool. But I do want to have time before we run for Succession. We got to close it out with Succession. Conor Roy, congrats on your, you know, your Emmy nomination this past year, supporting actor. Sort of a, I don't know how you'd call him, sort of the bizarre black sheep of the family. He's a funny character. But yeah. But I want to ask, you know, what was it like, you know, getting to play that character? He's sort of like a standout, kind of the oddball. What was your sort of approach to bringing him to screen?
Every now and then, this happens to me where I'm handed something where it's basically a license to steal. And the thing with Connor, I found out at the very beginning. I went to Adam McKay's house. It's a long story. I almost didn't audition for the show. Yeah. But I went to his house and I actually didn't even know the material. And he said, make it up. He said, you know the situation, right? Yeah. He said, make it up. Just, you know, improv. And so I did with Francine Maisler, who was the casting director. And there was one line, though, that was solid from the very beginning. And it was, Dad, there's this job I want. It's called President of the United States. And I said to Adam, well, clearly he's putting the old man on. Yeah. Yeah. And he said, oh, no. He's deadly serious. And so then that's when I knew that this guy was clearly delusional. Uh-huh. And as it, you know, came to be apparent during the filming of the show, I was given the most inane things to say. And there was no wink to it. There was nothing was tongue in cheek. Right. This was straightforward. So this guy, he was damaged goods. You know, I made up a whole backstory for him. I took clues from Jesse Armstrong and I made up a backstory that this guy was an only child. He knew that his dad was basically a prince because whenever Connor was with Logan, doors opened up and people bowed down and nobody could do enough for Logan or if I was with him for me. So I knew that I was privileged. I knew that things were special for me. And then the old man went away and he divorced my mother, who we found out had a pill problem and a vodka problem. And she was in and out of mental institutions. And so this was not a happy childhood for this boy. And so everything but love. There's plenty of money, very little love. And so I think from an early age, we talk about how he was interested in politics. I think from an early age, he built his own world. He built his own fantasy world. And the money was there to facilitate that. So I just felt like I could do no wrong. I just felt my job was to be brave. Like they gave me some idiotic thing to say. I just had to figure out why a person would say it, what kind of person would say a thing like that and truly believe it.
Right. Be dead serious about it. Yeah, exactly.
And so then I just, you know, filled in the blanks with some ADHD and some different types of mental illnesses. And then we got Connor.
Wow. Thank you. It's a great character. I mean, a whole cast of great characters and great performance in the writing and the whole thing. Well, I know we're tight on time, but I do want to ask sort of in the final seconds here. You were part of some of the most instantly iconic TV episodes with Succession. I mean, I want to know about shooting the Logan Roy death with Brian Cox's death episode with so much, you know, over the phone calls passing around and you're on the yacht or whatever. Just memories of shooting. I mean, yeah, the funeral episode was amazing too, but just tell me about the death episode. I think that'll go down as one of the best, the coolest, like one take sort of looking episodes ever.
Well, it was, again, it all comes back to the writing and, you know, we had been told months before that Logan was going to pass away in the third episode of the fourth season. And the fact that it happened on Connor's wedding day, it's so much, unfortunately, like life. I mean, death is never convenient. And, you know, life is what happens in between the plans that you've laid out,
right?
Or, you know, run steamrollers over the plans that you have made. And we were working on that yacht, and my brothers and my sister, Jeremy and Kieran and Snooki, I mean, they really carried the ball. They you know, they chopped most of the wood and carried most of the water in that episode, as well as Matthew McFadden. Just spectacular work. And then we shot everything, and then we decided to do an all-in-one. And they had, we did it like a play, and we were staged all over the boat. We had, you know, ADs and PAs saying, wait, don't go, don't go. Okay, go. And we would run into the next position, and they had camera, tag team camera crews. So there would be a camera. As soon as they were getting to roll, close to rolling out, the camera next to them would start shooting and would pick up the scene from there. And it was about a 23-minute take, I believe. And it was thrilling. It was one of the most thrilling things I've ever done. And I've been doing this for over 40 years. Yeah. And at the end of it, when they finally said cut, after about 23 minutes, the whole crew erupted in a cheer. I mean, you know, 100-plus people erupted in this magnificent cheer because everybody had brought their A game.
You knew,
and we did something. We
got
it, baby. Yeah. It was really wonderful. It was exciting.
Well, it was exciting for you. It was exciting for us to watch. I mean, it was incredible to watch that roll out. So congrats. Well, I think we'll wrap it back around now and remind everybody, Alan Ruck coming to DC's Warner Theater to screen Ferris Bueller's Day Off on Thursday, April 4th. Now you're going to be in DC. Final seconds. Is Connor could run. This could be the presidential time. You could announce on stage that you're running. There's still time. It's November's the election. So is this Connor's opportunity?
I think I'll have to talk to some people before I do that.
Well, actually, here's what I think you should do is I think you should come out wearing the Gordie Howe Cameron hockey, the Red Wings jersey, but midway through, take it off and have like a Washington Caps, like an Ovechkin or something underneath that. That'll make the crowd go wild.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Hey, thanks so much for doing this. This was fun.
Okay. Appreciate it.
All right. Chicka chicka.
Take care.
Thanks so much for listening to Beyond the Fame with Jason Fraley. Our theme music is Scott Buckley's Clarion. Remember to give us a 5-star rating if you like what you hear. We'll see you next time.